Chapter 3. Plans and Preparations. Steam rose from the sweating combatants as they circled each other in the palace courtyard. Two lads from the School of Arms with bared steel in their hands faced off against one young man in black sorcerer's garb, who stood half a head shorter than either of them. The smaller man was wielding a heavily padded wooden sword in both hands and appeared to be holding his own against the pair of younger fighters. The two lads worked well in tandem, continually trying to flank their opponent, who spun, slashed, and parried his way free of the traps they kept trying to lay for him. "He seems to be improving at least," Brannis commented, watching the practice session from afar. He was sitting at a small table set outdoors on a ground-level terrace just off the courtyard, sipping warmed cider in the cold morning air. Brannis was Grand Marshal of the Cadran Army, and wore his gold and quicksilver armor, covered in a doublet with both the Imperial Sigil and his own Solaran House crest. Young for such a lofty position, he wore the surprisingly comfortable magical armor, often, to give himself the appearance of authority to match his station. "His footwork is improving, and the technique is not the disaster it once was, but he lacks any strength behind the blows," replied Rashan. Despite looking even younger than Sir Brannis Solaran, Rashan was an uncle of his, some 5 generations removed. Unlike Brannis, he was strong in ether. The Empire had bred sorcerers for thousands of years to refine the hereditary aspects of what made for a potent sorcerer, and trained them at the Imperial Academy with the hope of teaching them the rest. Rashan Solaran was among the greatest successes of that endeavor. While sorcerers could be bred, warlocks were a chance occurrence. Sorcerers gifted enough in their own powers that they could use them safely amid the confusion and chaos of combat. Rashan was not only a warlock, he had learned the secret of immortality. After a century's absence during which he was believed dead, he had recently returned to the Empire. "What do you expect? You may have been throwing him out into the practice yard daily this past season, but last autumn that boy had hardly lifted anything heavier than a quill. A body takes time to harden," observed Fenris Destrier, a smallish, pudgy man with little hair left on his head. Fenris slumped, round-shouldered, in his chair as he cradled his own cider just below his face, letting the steam rising from it fill his nose with warm air. He could have used magic to warm himself, or at least keep away the chill. As a sorcerer of the Inner Circle, it would have been a scant test of his powers. But he did not wish to give the warlock the satisfaction of seeing him give in to dislike of the cold.
"You have seen the reports," Rashan said.
"Magrin is readying for an invasion. We do not have a season to prepare. We have perhaps half a season, if we are lucky. Iridan needs to be ready. He's just going to have to put in more of an effort. He does not have the luxury of a leisurely training regimen." The warlock was shorter and slighter of build than his son Iridan, with long white hair the color of fresh snow, and pale eyes that seemed to lack for any nameable color. For all the world, he seemed like a youth playing at being warlock, until he spoke. There was a manner about him that carried energy, authority, and menace. He could make underlings uneasy just by inquiring about the weather.
"Want me to stand in for the boys, then?" Brannis offered, half-joking. "I would use a padded blade, of course."
Brannis smiled at the last bit. His own sword was rune-forged, ancient and powerful. It was named Avalanche, and virtually nothing could impede it when swung. Even gravity had little hold over it, for outside its sheath, it would hang suspended in air, unless taken in hand. In battle, it cut through foe and fortification alike.
"You tempt me, Brannis, but no," Rashan answered.
"You may be stronger than both those lads at once, but you are no dancing blade master to be giving lessons. I promoted you for your brain, not your blade. If we were to be facing an ogre uprising, I would see the wisdom in preparing him against you, but the Magrin fighters tend to be more nimble and skilled. Young as they are, both those boys fight more soundly than do you."
"He is taking too many blows against his shielding spell," Fenris said. gesturing toward Iridan with his nose so he did not have to remove his hands from the warm cup. The blow to his stomach had registered vaguely in Iridan's mind. He felt it not in the flesh, but in his sense of the ether. He was not harmed. He knew that the steel blades his opponents wielded would not hurt him so long as his shielding spell held. His swordsmanship was just not up to the task on its own yet. Jafin and Moln had maneuvered Iridan directly between them, as they always tried to do. Iridan only had one sword and no shield, so he could only defend himself from one side at a time. Iridan watched their timing, then stepped quickly aside and out of reach of Jafin, launching a spinning attack at Moln, the better fighter of the two boys. The squires hated the attack and used to remind him how foolish it was. Iridan knew that the knights favored a defensive, tactical approach to swordsmanship, waiting for an error by their opponent and trying to force them into making one if none was forthcoming. Rashan had given Iridan extensive tutoring on how a warlock ought to fight before turning him loose against the finest lads, aged 14 summers or younger, of the School of Arms. Iridan used his ether vision instead of the light to see during combat. It filtered out all the non-essentials of color and background and inanimate objects, leaving him a full view all around him of ether, and he saw his opponents by their sources. The drawback was that swords had no source and were virtually invisible to him, but he had been learning to judge the path of a weapon by the way it was wielded. Posture, momentum, fighting style, all gave clues once he knew how to interpret them. Moln knew that he could strike a quick blow before Iridan completed his spin, but this attack was one he had seen before. The would-be warlock could take the hit on his shielding spell, and there would be no defense from Iridan's own attack if he did not devote himself to avoiding it. Typically, Moln would either hop back out of reach, keeping his sword clear of Iridan's to force him to continue the spin, or switch to a two-handed grip and meet the blow hard with a parry. This time, Moln tried something new. He hopped back and lifted his sword clear, similar to how he often did, but he followed in immediately after the warlock's sword cleared him and struck a quick blow down on the blade. Iridan had been preparing to follow around and counter the attack that was already coming from Jafin at his back. Moln's blow was solid enough to force his sword down and cause him to stumble in his swing. Jafin struck him square in the back, hard enough to have cut his spine had he not been shielded by ether. Moln closed in quickly, and a blow to the temple turned Iridan's head to the side, dizzying and disorienting him. "Enough!" Rashan shouted from across the courtyard. It seemed that he had seen all he needed to for the day's practice. "Good work, lads. The day is yours yet again." The warlock reached into a pouch at his belt and removed two gold lions, tossing one coin to each boy. "You have earned it. Spend it well, and I shall see you back here tomorrow morning." The two squires gathered themselves up in presentable fashion, and once they had sheathed their blades, saluted the warlock, fist to chest. "Yes, warlock," they replied in unison. Rashan dismissed them and walked a few paces to where his son was on hands and knees, waiting for the world to hold still enough to stand atop it. "They are learning more than you are out here," Rashan said. "Are two of them too much for you? I could invite back just Moln for tomorrow's session, if you cannot handle Jafin and him together. They both have more experience at this than I do, and Moln is bigger than me," Iridan said, breathing heavily. "That is the sorriest excuse you have used yet. I am trying to train you here, not puff your ego. If you had been armed and trained, you might not have been defeated by that Magrin sorcerer at Rainsdark. You might have prevented the Magrin from obtaining the staff of Galen," Rashan said. "That's unfair. I was barely walking after exhausting myself defending the wall." "A sword in my hand would not have made a difference," Iridan said, pushing himself up to his knees as he stood. He bent to retrieve his wooden sword. "I disagree. You attack where your opponent is weak, defend where he was strong. You attacked from surprise and stunned him. I have no quarrel with that. But then you sought to defend yourself instead of finishing him.
You allowed a more seasoned sorcerer to have his turn at attacking. He had one worry, and you allowed him respite from it to formulate an attack, Roshan said, having gone through the same argument with Iridan several times on previous occasions when he questioned his training. But I was undefended. A quick spell could have been the end of me, and precisely why you need to learn to fight. Draw ether into your shielding spells from close range. Your draw is still stronger than most, and you could strengthen your own defenses while denying him ether. This needs to be second nature. All the while you press him in close combat. His spells must be cast quickly or done silently, and you may force errors. The warlock's trade is not so easy. Few can manage to keep their wits clear enough to manage such a task while a sword is threatening their hide. But I, Iridan began, but Roshan cut him off again. Speaking of your draw, Fenris is ready for you. Roshan smiled mischievously. Iridan's swordsmanship lesson might have been done, but his day of training was not yet at an end. Excuse me, Fenris muttered to Brannis as he rose. They had both been watching the exchange between Roshan and Iridan, and Brannis knew that the warlock was ready for Fenris to take his turn with the boy. 94 springtimes old, Fenris was now the senior member of the inner circle, excepting the warlock, whose birth was a matter for history books. Fenris's joints ached, his eyesight was not so strong, and he found his thoughts wandering more than they used to. For all that, his source was strong, and so was his draw. The warlock's lackeys had worn Iridan down physically, and Brannis knew that it was now Fenris's duty to wear him down by the source. Each day it was the same routine, with small variations. Practice at arms, then a draw against one of the inner circle. Roshan had made a mistake early in Iridan's training, and had followed up sparring against a lad of 13 summers with a draw against a third circle sorcerer. While Iridan had been battered and bruised by his adolescent sword-fighting tutor, he had embarrassed the poor sorcerer he had faced. Ever since, he had only been matched against the inner circle. So far, Iridan had shown that he could overmatch his great-great-great-great-niece, Aloysia, 8 summers his elder, the next youngest member of the inner circle, and could give Thael Greydusk an even match, or even defeat him at times. Roshan had not wanted Iridan to have easy matches. He wanted to temper and reforge him. Iridan had not defeated Fenris in 8 draws. He had not fared well against Caladrus, Brannis's and Aloysia's uncle, and 50 summers Iridan's elder, in any of the 12 bouts they had. Dolvain Lurien had drawn against Iridan just the once. A lowborn sorcerer from a bloodline not even accorded the status of lesser. It was clear that Dolvain had gained his position among the inner circle by skill and power, not patronage. The draw between him and Iridan had been brief, decisive, and humbling for the younger sorcerer. Brannis watched as the old sorcerer made his way out into the courtyard to contest against Iridan. There was a temptation to stay and watch, just to see the result, but Brannis would take no enjoyment in it. Iridan was nearly guaranteed to lose, and Brannis was blind to the ether, and thus could not even properly spectate the event. The two sorcerers would stand several paces apart, and upon command of whoever was judging the contest, they would each call upon the ether to see whose draw was more powerful. If neither was clearly stronger, they would be commanded to stop drawing and hold the ether they had drawn for as long as possible. Stored ether burned. The more a sorcerer held, the stronger the burning, and careless bravado could result in serious injury. Brannis, alone at the table after Fenris's departure, rose to make his own exit. For all Brannis would see, it would be 2 sorcerers standing and staring at each other, until suddenly one was declared winner. The first clue to an ether-blind observer as to who was winning might be a blast of steam from the water basins, into which the losing sorcerer would discharge his stored ether to signal his defeat. Brannis had better uses for his time, and many responsibilities. Even staying for the sparring was beyond what he had intended in visiting with Warlock Roshan. Brannis had merely needed to give him the status of the reported Megrin troop movements. As usual, the information was scant, received third and fourth hand from traders and travelers. The Empire's own information sources were scattered and ineffective. Long years of focusing on internal squabbles among the powers of the Kadrin Empire had left their foreign information sources undermanned. It was a constant annoyance to the warlock, and Brannis felt little better about it himself. Though Rashaan had said nothing yet to Brannis, Kadrin's young marshal suspected that the old warlock had some plan to remedy that deficiency. Brannis spent much of the afternoon meeting with various officers and representatives of noble landholders who bordered on Megrin. Troop strength and readiness discussions always discouraged him. The borderlands were better defended than the Empire's interior, with ogres, bandits, and raiding to contend with. They had to be. But none had the sort of standing army to contend with the reported numbers the Megrin were amassing. Brannis looked at the map of the continent of Coria, laid out on its own massive table. Kadrin occupied most of the south, all of the east, and a bit of the northeast as well, wrapping cautiously around the ogre lands. Megrin was tiny by comparison, a federation of city-states along the north coast on both sides of the Cloudwall mountain range. It was a populous land for its size, but even at that, they had fewer than a tenth Kadrin citizenry. What troubled Brannis was the vast expanse past Megrin to the north. Across the Aliani Sea in every direction lay nations that traded with the Megrin, providing weapons, food, sellswords, and the exotic mounts that the Megrin preferred over horses for their heavy cavalry. Brannis picked up a small painted clay figurine representing a striped cat with a rider. The green and brown stripes helped the creatures hide in their native jungles, far away in Elok, but would give them little advantage in the rolling plains and forested countryside that formed the Kadrin border with Megrin. He looked at the rider sitting atop it, an afterthought with a tiny spear and shield, guiding the deadly beast with his knees. By accounts of the older knights who had seen them in person, the scale was correct and daunting. The creature was more than head height at the shoulder. Brannis set it back down on the map just south of the Megrin capital city of Zoran, where it represented a unit of actual striped cats that his spies had reported being based there. Brannis's map was littered with similar toy military units, helping his generals understand more intuitively where their forces and the enemy troops were arrayed. There was a logbook so that any time figures were added, moved, or taken away, it was noted with the time and exact nature of the change in case the truth of any bit of intelligence be brought into question. The map with figurines was inspired by something that Kyrus had seen once in the drawing room of the Society of Learned Men in Scar Harbor. It had been set up to depict the Battle of Garlow Falls, but that was not what had caught Kyrus's fancy. He had been fascinated by the tiny soldiers and horses, each representing a number of real ones that had been present at the battle. Forces had been arrayed across half of Acardia during that period of the Staltner Revolution, but with the aid of a hooked stick to slide the figures around, one of the professors had explained the battle to Kyrus in just a few minutes. Brannis and his generals were now using the same technique to track all Kadrin troop movements and what they could learn of the Megrin and their allies. A few local tradesmen had made the figures in short order and had done a marvelous job of rendering the various martial assets in exacting detail. Brannis only wished he had cause to purchase more of them, since they showed a rather embarrassing imbalance in strength. The Megrin had obviously planned and saved for this invasion for many winters. They probably borrowed coin as well, with a promise to repay in plunder. Kadrin could eventually build up to the point where the Megrin army would fall to them by sheer numbers. But conscripts fought poorly, and proper soldiers took winters to train. It was one thing to show a man which end of a spear was which and drape a mail shirt over him. It was another to teach him not to break ranks the first time he saw an 800-gallon monohorn thundering toward him. In fairness, the proper response was a withdrawal action, which was distinctly not running away. the major problems Brannis saw were twofold. First, they were not going to be allowed the years needed to properly remilitarize the population and increase the standing army to the size they would need to repel such a force as the Magrin were arraying against them. Were it not for the extreme aversion Stripecats and Monohorns had to the cold of Cadren winter, Magrin likely would have already attacked. So Brannis hoped for a long, cold winter to persist past the equinox. The second problem was Jinzan Feyre. He knew too much. Like Brannis, Jinzan was aware of the other world, Tellurak, where technology was more developed and magic all but unheard of. Jinzan had already used that connection to barter the knowledge of cannon-making to the goblins, in return for working units and an invasion of Rainsdark that also gained him the staff of Galen. Surely at some point in the war, the Cadren forces would once again be faced with cannons of Akkadian design. Brannis also had no way of predicting what further aid the Magrin sorcerer might import from Akkadia or other lands of Tellurak, which Brannis had begun whimsically to think of as Kyrus World. The staff Brannis could do little about, but he could at least try to match cannon to cannon with Jinzan, figuratively at least. Brannis suspected that black powder alchemy was probably too tricky to teach the chemists and apothecaries in Cadrus, atop the fact that Kyrus would have to reach mainland somewhere civilized to learn the exact recipes he would need. Sorcery might fabricate working cannons if Kyrus could find one to take measurements from, but that had the same problem of too little knowledge, too far from where it could be learned. Instead, Brannis had taken a different approach. The maps and clay soldiers were a small thing compared with cannons. Let the pirate who was Jinzan's counterpart in Kyrus World worry about those. Brannis had thought of a better source of ideas to import. Fairy tales. Tales of magic, monsters, and heroes existed in Brannis's own world, but he had begun to realize, once he thought of it, that they lacked the whimsy and imagination of those in Kyrus World. It made sense after a fashion. If a sorcerer heard a story of magic that sounded implausible, he would tell you six different ways that it was wrong and could not happen as written. It stifled creativity and limited the boundaries that could be tested by imagination. Brannis had dug through Kyrus's memories for inspiration and was drawing up plans of his own.
I understand the decorum and omens involved in a winter wedding, but with the threat of Magrin hanging poised at our throats, should we not perhaps move the date forward? Shader Archon asked Roshan.
A tall, dignified, second circle sorcerer, Shader sat next to his wife in one of the Imperial Palace's more private sitting rooms, sharing tea with their daughter's future oath father.
I hear your concern, but I feel better about waiting for springtime. Besides, every day we wait gives us more time to muster our strength. We will not strike first in this war. We may not even strike second. We must ensure only that we strike last, Roshan said, taking a sip of his tea, mostly for appearance's sake. As an immortal, demon in less flattering parlance, he had no need of food or drink, but then he supposed that no creature, mortal or not, truly required tea for any purpose but to sip it politely among company. It had a weak, bitter taste that he did his best to ignore.
Would it not make sense to have our new warlock prepared for the inevitable war, with his marriage pact sealed and consummated? Shader argued.
Aha, thought Roshan. There is the heart of his argument. He wants a grandson in case Iridan gets himself killed in battle.
Rest assured, Iridan's preparations for the wedding will run in parallel with his training as a warlock. Every additional day of training makes him stronger for when I finally loose him upon the Magrin, Roshan replied. The warlock genuinely liked Shader. Had he known the man prior to his realignment of the inner circle, he would have promoted him in place of Brannis's sister Aloysia, who was rather sadly underprepared for her elevation. The conversation shifted to more tedious matters of decoration, attendees, and other logistical arrangements. Roshan let his mind wander a bit and allowed Ophelia Archon
a slightly older-looking version of her daughter, down to the ether-tinted reddish-gold hair, to dominate the discussion. Rashaan wanted the event to carry all the pageantry and glamour of a royal wedding, but cared little for how that was managed. He objected only once, when the idea of Brannis acting as Iridan's oathkeeper was suggested. "He may be Iridan's best friend," Rashaan said, "and it would normally be expected. But I think in this circumstance it may be better to bend tradition and find another friend of Iridan's to fill that role." Rashaan tiptoed around the subject that Juliana's parents would rather not have brought up, Brannis' former betrothal to their daughter. Rashaan had never been able to extract from either of them just what had passed between them. But he expected that, around the age of 13, Brannis and Juliana had taken news of their arranged marriage rather well. Cadran's new Grand Marshal still carried the girl in his heart, more so than Rashaan would have preferred, given that the feeling seemed mutual. Brannis was rational in all other things, so it was readily forgivable, but Rashaan feared to let the lad stand as oathkeeper all the same. It was a seldom exercised post, hearkening back to the more tumultuous days of the Empire, when bloodshed rode on the success of marriage alliances between noble houses. The oathkeeper's duty was to see that the groom kept his promise to wed his bride. In olden times, this meant dogging the groom's steps for a 10-day or longer prior to the ceremony. But in present-day Cadran, the duty amounted to just a day's shepherding and good-natured carousing. The houses of the major sorceress bloodlines styled themselves after noble houses in this way, as in many others, and kept the tradition in their own weddings as well. Brannis, for all his apparent blunt and straightforward honesty, kept a merchant's tongue in his mouth. Leave him for a day with Iridan, and Brannis might end up wedded to Juliana in his son's stead. Such was the duty of an oathkeeper. To seal the pact between houses, if he failed to ensure the groom fulfilled his oath. "Perhaps that sorcerer who saved his life at Rainsdark, Phelan Sarmon," Shader suggested, seeming glad that someone else had put Brannis out of the discussion for oathkeeper. Rashaan knew that Shader and Ophelia both adored Brannis and had looked forward to having him for an oath son, but the complications between him and Juliana were awkward enough that they were both happy to have them clear of each other on her wedding day. "Phelan is otherwise occupied. Perhaps we could find someone he knew at the academy," Rashaan said. He had found the gifted illusionist Phelan to be surprisingly resourceful and had already developed other plans for him that did not involve oathkeeper duties. "I shall ask around a bit. Surely there must be someone else he was rather close with," Ophelia said. "And I do not know quite how to bring this up, but there is one other matter I had wished to discuss with you."
"Yes?"
Rashaan leaned closer, intrigued by whatever matter seemed to be disconcerting Ophelia Archon, third circle sorceress and part of one of the most influential families in the Empire.
"Well, what of Iridan's mother? Will she be attending?" Ophelia asked. "We are both quite curious to meet her."
Rashaan Solaran stared wide-eyed, mouth parted slightly, struck dumb for lack of words for the first time in longer than he could remember.
"I had forgotten," he finally admitted at length.
After a long pause, he added, "I will contact her shortly and inquire." "Have I really been enjoying my time here so much, political snake handling and all, that I forgot all about her? Everyone except Brannis has probably been too frightened of me to even ask about her. And that was a season ago. Even Iridan seems to avoid the subject for some reason." Iridan shuffled across his bedchamber in the palace, where he had relocated after Rashaan appointed him as the next Cadran warlock. He was stiff and bruised, despite the protection his shielding spell had granted him. If not for his father's intervention, the boys might have done him real harm. Dazed as he was from the blow to the temple, he would not have properly reinforced his protective magics before they struck again. "Blasted urchins," he cursed under his breath.
aware that no one was around to either hear him or be bothered by his mutterings. He had begun talking to himself more than he preferred, which was an easy habit to get into when few others would take up a share of the conversation on your behalf. Since Roshan had formally acknowledged Iridan as his son and began training him as warlock, people had looked at him differently. Casual acquaintances no longer met his gaze when he passed them in the halls or out in the streets. Servants and guards snapped to his every implied order, even when he was merely making helpful suggestions. The sorcerers of the Imperial Circle at large treated him coolly and seemed offended by his rapid promotion. No less offended were the Inner Circle, who now were forced to call Iridan a colleague rather than an underling. None of them disputed his talent or potential, but the favoritism shown by Warlock Roshan for his newly acknowledged son rubbed them ill. Among the many ways the latter had manifested itself was the very room he now occupied. With the charade of the false emperor exposed, there was no one to tell the warlock how best to allocate the palace's accommodations. Spending so much time there himself, the warlock had arranged for his son and the commander of his armies to move into vacant rooms. Despite being only several doors away from one another, Iridan hardly saw Brannis anymore.
"I wish Brannis were not so busy. I know he has an army to look after now, but at least he doesn't seem bothered by me being a warlock. He probably has the same feeling, being thrown off a cliff and told to fly, offending the birds as he plummets past them." Iridan shook his head. He poured himself a glass of sweetened wine from a decanter left for him by his ever-attentive servants. He had dismissed them after arriving back from his morning practice session. It was only mid-afternoon, but it was his fourth glass. It sped the passing of a long day and dulled the aches in his body. That evening, in a different palace bedchamber, Brannis set aside his pen and ink and took up a book entitled To Anywhere. After Kyrus's test against the Katamic Sea, Brannis felt he might finally be ready to try learning the transference spell contained within its age-yellowed pages. Like many of the books from the Circle's libraries, it had aged well due to magical means of preservation. Similarly protected, steel would last for entire eras, and stone was nearly eternal. Paper could be kept for hundreds of summers, but eventually would need to be rewritten and replaced. Annotations inside the front cover of the book indicated that it was the third copy of the book, and the inscription put this copy at over 300 summers old itself. Transference was one of the more difficult and dangerous spells of which sorcerers were widely aware. It took literally two identically sized chunks of the world and exchanged them in space. Without special modifications, and why anyone would wish to further complicate such a spell was beyond Brannis's understanding, the chunks of space would both be spherical in shape, with one centered about the caster, and as large as the sorcerer had ether to make it. The latter was one of the most obvious pitfalls of the spell. The book was nothing if not explicit in its warnings of the perils of the spell. Should the spell be cast without enough ether to fully surround the sorcerer, a rather grisly package might end up delivered to some far-flung destination, whatever chunk of the sorcerer was on the inside of the sphere when it formed. Another was the matter of where one ended up. As a part of the spell, the mind would be cast into the ether to find a place for the companion sphere to form. Traveling the world mentally could be dizzying, and the landscape, rendered all in shades of blue-white ether, would look nothing like it would in the realm of light. A keen observer would be able to discern terrain and structures from the way the flow of ether was impeded by them, but they would not be obvious. Sources would be easy to spot, but without foreknowledge of to whom a source belonged, many sorcerers would find it difficult to distinguish between a man or a woman, let alone identify one uniquely. Brannis sighed. If Kyrus ended up missing his mark and burying himself below a mountain or deep underwater, he would be sorely pressed to save himself. Too high seemed the safer error, since Kyrus could at least levitate himself, but Brannis would prefer being no party to that either.
Doxlo intuve Menep, Gahaliksviu, Brannis began, reading the chant from the book aloud as he pantomimed the gestures of the spell as it described them, intricate weavings of the fingers, with little motion of the rest of the body. The chant was long and tedious, exacting in pronunciation by the book's own admission, and above all, dangerous. Kairos would have to be very careful in practicing the spell, lest he injure himself horribly. Brannis, of course, had nothing to worry about from practice, and Kairos learned nearly as well from Brannis's work as from his own.
"This is for you, Kairos. You have earned it many times over. This is thanks for discovering Jinzan Fair's plot, and for forcing him to barter my life for his counterparts in your own world. Thank you for letting me feel what it is like to use magic. And thank you for paying attention when your grandfather read you Captain Erasmus and his flying ship."
Brannis paused at the end of his third run-through of the transference spell chant and looked at the papers he had set neatly aside prior to resuming his magical studies. Below a fanciful sketch of a sailing ship with feathered wings were pages of diagrams and annotations showing how and where wards ought to be carved to turn one of Cadran's warships into an airship.